I have a lot of Coke Zero with me, so I will be on.
He's caffeinated. He is ready for the hard questions.
I am so caffeinated, you all. You have no idea.
So how many cats are going to be in the next book, John?
Oh, geez. Well, I think most of you, if you follow me online at all, know that we have just gotten a new kitten, Saja, which I didn't intend to get, right? My daughter found a bunch of kittens in a parking lot and was like, I must save these kittens. And so all of a sudden we had a bunch of kittens in the house, and I actually responsibly rehomed all of them after we made sure that they were healthy and took them to the vet and all that sort of stuff. But at the last moment, the person who was going to take Saja, right, was not able to. Turns out, and this is a tip for all of you, that if you want to have a kitten in your house, maybe make sure your spouse is okay with it too. We're up here, someone just nudged their spouse. Sir, are you going to get a cat?
I'm the spouse.
Or the spouse. Surprise, here's a cat. We're going to be distributing kittens at the end of the day. And it's been great. The Saja is just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful kitten, except at 3 a.m. in the fucking morning when he's like, I must eat your face. Like, he'll literally just pop up onto the bed and just be like, and what he's doing is he's like nuzzling, you know, because he's still a kitten and he's, you know, he's like, there's that nipple in there somewhere. No, there is not. There's not. I actually, he chewed on the top of my ear enough that it actually like bled. And so, of course, you know, I had, and Chrissy was like, oh no, now he has a taste for blood. So we'll see. I'm away for 2 weeks. Possibly the cat will have broken the habit by then. We will see. But I guarantee you 100% that if I fall down the stairs because a small black kitten is there and I didn't see it, that kitten will then eat me. I already know that. So
I remember having a kitten, and I don't think I slept for the first 3 weeks. I was a nutcase by the time it was done.
Oh no! I mean, I will tell you this: I am happy to go on tour for many reasons. But number two or three is, I will get to sleep through the entire night, because I won't have either Saja, the cat, trying to eat my face, or Spice the cat pawing me awake and going, hey, 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 here's my butt. I have two separate cats who have really different reasons to wake me up at 3 a.m., but wake me up they do. And then once they do, the dog is like, oh, are you up? Because I could go pee right now. So it's a whole thing. Like, I am up between the hours of 3 and 6 every day, you know, dealing with pet issues. But now, I get to sleep all night long. It's going to be amazing. I'm going to bed super early just to catch up on the sleep. Yes? Yeah, that's the thing is the cats just think that they're doing you a favor by being underfoot. Here's something that's absolutely true. So I'm 56 now. When I turned 40, I started reaching for the railing at the stairs no matter what. Because we do have four cats and a dog who is just like glump, 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 right? I'm gonna die on those stairs if I don't just have the muscle memory to always go for the railing. So, hi, we're talking about my book.
Yes, we are, but actually, everybody's more interested probably in the cats.
Everybody loves the cats. And, you know, and of course, the thing is that when we got the kittens, people are like, now you have three cats. And I'm like, no. You know, in fact, like two of the kittens went together as a pair to a new home. And it's great because the new owner sends me pictures of the cats in the new home. And I feel so accomplished, right? You know, it's like, yes, I published books, but what I really did was a rehome a cat. That was amazing.
You know, the little accomplishments wherever we can go, right?
It's me and St. Francis of Assisi. Really, it's exactly. It's just that close.
You know, what's fun and amazing is you've rehomed a cat, you've gone to France.
Yes.
And you wrote two books in about a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're and from what I hear, you're building a massive enterprise as well. So you're probably already awake at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I really wish I wasn't, though. So, it is true. You know, here's the funny thing, which is I tell people that I am the laziest person I know. And then I go, but I did put out two books this year. And there's going to be a novella that's coming out in November and a short story that's going to come out in October. And I had two episodes of a TV series this year all the other things that I did. And I'm 100% certain that from the outside, it looks like I'm industrious as hell, right? But in fact, I still feel I'm like super, super, super lazy because I'm doing this as writing. And writing for me is, I don't want to say it's not work because it absolutely is 100% work, but everything else would be like pulling teeth for me to do. Like, right. Like this is the work that conforms most accurately to my ADHD, right? Like this is the thing that that I can just do as a process that sort of makes sense to me. And I'm fortunate that I can write quickly so that, you know, I can do two books in a year. Although that's kind of a lie. I mean, I didn't have a book out last year. This was the book that would have been out last year. But the problem was that Tor only had one date to have me put out a book last year in 2024, and that was November 6th. I'm just waiting for you all to realize what day that was. Yep. Yep, and we were like, "Oh, let's not do that." And so we just moved it to March instead. So
we've discovered that we will never have an event on November 6th, and we will never have an event on tax day because nobody shows up.
Nobody shows up. Nobody shows up. No, don't do it on election day. Don't do it on tax day. That makes perfect sense to me. Avoid like Easter. You know,
exactly.
Christmas is not a great time. Christmas Eve, maybe. But you guys have other things to be doing on Christmas Eve, I'm sure.
But oh, sure. But
there's a whole science to this. I mean, they typically put out my books either in March and April or September and October because those just seem to be the time where you all want to buy books. And that's also makes it easier for us to do like promotion. Like this book came out in March, which was perfectly timed for a whole bunch of conventions that I could do. Same with this one. I'm going to go on a 2-week book tour. And then after that, I was at a convention last week. I was at Rose City Comic Con, which was lovely. And then I will be going to book festivals in the New York City Comic Con, in Iowa, in Vermont, in San Francisco. Just I'm all over the place, right? And that's just because that's where they all seem to cluster, so that's why they put me out. Which is also why tomorrow there's like 14,000 books coming out. Thank you for buying mine and not theirs. I mean, you can buy theirs too. That would be fine. Just buy mine first.
It's why I work in a bookstore. It's to pay for my book addiction, and it's a lot of fun. And you're right. When you're working and doing something that you absolutely love, it doesn't feel like you're working. Right?
Yeah.
When I'm here, it's a blast because I think book people are the best people in the world. Mm-hmm. Writers are incredible because you get to put out just amazing, amazing, you know, where they come from in your mind, I do not know, sir. But you, every book that I read of yours is just phenomenal. Now, we're not going to go really super in-depth on the Shattering piece, by the way, because A, the book has not come out yet. We are lucky enough. John has been kind enough to come a day early, and Tor has been kind enough to say, yeah, it's close enough to midnight in New York City. So, yeah, you can do it. So we don't want to spoil this book for you.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm really curious. So we've got Gretchen Trujillo back.
Right.
And, you know, first of all, rave reviews everywhere. And we were talking about this in the back. I was incredibly impressed. Kirkus gave you a great review because they're usually like the troll of the literary world.
God love Kirkus. I mean, the thing about Kirkus is that they really, Kirkus is a trade magazine, right? And so it's like Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, except for books. And their reviews are generally like very pointed, to the point of scathing. And I remember like the review for Red Shirts was, oh my God, it was so bad. It was like, check the date. If it's not April 1st, you've been had, you know. And, you know, they were like, if you're a sophomore, then maybe you will like this, you know, because it was sophomoric. And I was just like, damn, Kirkus. Who hurt you? So the fact that they liked this one made me really happy. It was really funny because in this particular book, When the Moon Hits Your Eye, I have a character whose book comes out and it gets starred reviews in Library Journal and Publishers Weekly, and then Kirkus gives it a bad review. And in the book itself, you know, the writer of that book is like, wow, that's harsh. And then their agent is like, oh, honey, Kirkus doesn't, you know, hire people who are capable of joy. And then Kirkus gave this a starred review. And the very last line in the review was like, oh, by the way, I see what you did there. I'm like, damn, Kirkus. Someone's being spicy. But yeah, no, as far as it goes, so far, people have been responding really well to it, which makes me very happy. I mean, the trade reviews have been good. The early Goodreads reviews have been nice. And people seem to be excited to come back into the universe. It's been 10 years since the most recent book in the series. So I think it was the right time to come back and sort of reacquaint people with the universe.
And you could, I'm sure, as a writer, you're kind of like your readers. If you're not enjoying what you're writing, or, you know, you're getting a little tired of something, you want to do something a little bit different, and you're not afraid to do that.
No, and I will tell you why. I mean, here's the thing is, like, so Old Man's War has 7 books in it over the course of 20 years. And but one of the things that I think was real important, there was one point where my editor once said to me, in a moment of not actually paying attention to what he was saying and then freaking me the hell out, and this was early on, he was like, you know, you could just write Old Man's War books every other book, and we literally wouldn't care what the other book was, because they knew that those books would be the ones that people would buy and stuff like that. And what he was saying was just purely from the business point of view, right? You know, right. It's like every other book, making an Old Man's War book, we will all be rich among, you know, above the dreams of avarice, and it'll be fine. And it struck me with a holy terror, you know, the idea of every other book having to be an Old Man's War book, because I love the Old Man's War universe, but I'm also extremely sensitive to the idea that there are series, and it's not just in science fiction, they're also in other genres as well, where you have that whiff of contractual obligation to them. And that's no fun for anybody. And some people will just pick them up because they know what they're getting, and there's a, you know, minimum standard of competence and everything else like that. And that's perfectly fine. I don't want to run that down. But for me, it was important that if I'm doing books in the Old Man's War series in particular, because it is my signature, when I die, when I am hit by a bus, drowned by a dolphin, however it is that I go, trip on a cat, my obituary is John Scalzi, writer of Old Man's War and other books, dead by cat, age 57, right? So I know Old Man's War is going to be on my obituary, right? So as far as it goes, I don't want to do anything in this series that I'm not, like, super interested in. And that's one of the reasons why it was 10 years between the End of All Things and this book. Because for a number of years, I was like, I left it in a good place. I don't want to have – I'm not thinking about that universe, and I'm not going to force myself to think about that universe if I'm not particularly interested in going back to it. It took 7 years – until, like, a story presented itself that I wanted to do within that universe. And then once I was like, okay, I know what I want to, what story I want to tell. I know what character I want to use. I wanted to use Gretchen Trujillo, who is Zoe's best friend in Zoe's Tale. And once I knew then I also looked at my schedule and I was like, oh, 2025, 20th anniversary of Old Man's War. Why don't we put it there? And so that's part of the reason why it is there. But before the calculus of celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Old Man's War series with a new installment happened, before that happened, there had to have been a story that I loved and I wanted to tell. Otherwise, we would have just been like, yeah, it's been 20 years. Wow. And that would have been it.
And yeah, exactly. And that celebration of the 20 years and the 6 books, but you've given us a 7th. Mm-hmm. Where did Gretchen come from? What was the spark?
I mean, I liked the character of Gretchen. The secret truth is, and it's not secret because I say it all the time, honestly, is that Zoe's Tale is my favorite book in the series. I'm not saying that it's necessarily the best book in the series, but it is my favorite book in the series. And part of that is because Zoe, my daughter was 8 at the time, and I imagined who my daughter would be at age 16 and wrote Zoe to be that person. And then when my daughter turned 16, nailed it. It was great. But the characters of Zoe and Gretchen and the way they had their interactions, and then the interactions with Enzo and Magdi, who are their, you know, boyfriends and all of that, just that of that group, the communication that they had, I really liked those characters. And so I was always thinking about Gretchen in the sense of, would there be a way to bring her back? Because I was curious to see what sort of person that she had grown up to be. So I knew that I didn't want to bring Zoe back, just like I didn't want to bring back John and Jane, because the Perry Sagan family has earned their happy ending. They get to go have a life beyond the books. But I also know that there's a fondness for the characters, right? That's one of the reasons why Harry Wilson, who was a side character in the first arc of the Old Man's War books, was the main character in the second arc. And so when it came time to do it again, I was like, I want to bring Gretchen forward. It's a way to keep the continuity of characters within the universe, but at the same time progress the story. And so, you know, once you're like, well, I know that I want to do something with that character, then you start thinking, well, who is that character going to be? She's still going to be that person with attitude and the skills that she has and everything else like that. But she has to have grown up. She's in her mid-30s in this book. And so you just think about all that sort of stuff, and eventually thinking about that and how you would build that character, that's the seed on which everything else grew.
I always read your books as almost thrillers first, science fiction second, just because of the pacing associated with it. And you don't go so deep in the science that, I mean, it's very poignant and pointed and very well put together, but we're not lost in pages and pages of overt description.
Well, there's a good reason for that. I'm not that smart, right? I mean, I'm plenty smart, don't get me wrong, but I stopped being able to understand math in the 8th grade. Like, the quadratic equation was it for me, right? I took 4 more years of math. I can't tell you what I did, you know, but so there was that. But the other thing is that I've also found that purely as a matter of science fiction, if you don't describe stuff in detail, then the people who have the knowledge and understanding of the things will spin around in their own heads the way to make it work. Whereas if you go and overly try to describe something, the nerds will catch you out. They'll be like, you did that wrong. You did that wrong. Do you want to know how you did it wrong? I'm going to tell you all the ways that you did it wrong. And like for example, in When the Moon Hits Your Eye, right? There was a there was an error, which we will hopefully fix for the version of it that goes into paperback, where it talks about the Earth spins but the Moon doesn't. And immediately I got 20 emails from people, well, you know, technically it does spin. It's just that it always shows the same face to the Earth. And I'm like, you fucking nerds, man. You just won't. I mean, it was that thing was written for like 5-year-olds. Don't overly complicate it with physics. But we will fix that in the paperback. But that this is my point is like they will 100% catch you out on your errors, and they're not wrong to do it. You're not wrong to do it. I wish you wouldn't, but you're not wrong to do it. So if you don't over-explain things, they will provide the explanations to you, and then they will come and tell you what they think these things are. Again, a moon hits your eye. The moon turns to cheese. I never tell you what kind of cheese it is, because if I did, you'd be like, I did the math and the albedo's wrong. But by not telling you what kind of cheese it is, I've had some of you come up and be like, I figured out what cheese it is. I want you to know it's this. And they will tell me. And I'm like, that's amazing. Could be. I didn't think about it that much. But, you know.
They're always so fun. I mean, you've got a great sense of humor in your books. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just shines on the page. There's not a point where I feel really sad reading a Scalzi book. I do not want to put my head in the oven when I'm done reading you.
I mean, good? I mean, there are times I want you to cry.
Right, exactly.
Right. But I don't want you to come out of with the exception of the God Engines, where I absolutely 100% wanted you to finish that book and be like, well, shit, everything's doomed. But that was the whole point of writing that one, was to make the point that I don't have to write the cheerful, optimistic stuff that I do. I actually have a larger palette of things to write. But generally speaking, no. I mean, two things are up with that. One, I get bored as a reader and as a writer. If what I'm writing bores me, then it's going to bore you. And I am not so precious with myself that I can't tell when I'm writing crap, right? And in fact, I'm kind of vicious with myself. In terms of, like, I will be writing something, and I'm just like, why do I have to keep writing this? And it's like, that's immediately chuck that out and start over. So I have a very, hair trigger for boredom when I'm writing. So as far as that goes, that transfers over to the books tend to be well-paced, they tend to be funny, they tend to move along, all of that sort of stuff, because I don't want to bore myself when I'm writing. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that honestly, I believe that humans eventually do the right thing after they've done everything else wrong first. Yeah. And I know that in this moment, you're like, I don't know about that. But, you know, let's all hope that we can get through this. But that being the case, my books are ultimately kind of optimistic. It's not that bad things don't happen in the books. It's not that I treat my characters with kid gloves. I'm sure all of you can think of all the times that I've taken one of your favorite characters and did horrible, horrible things to them, which they deserved, because the story required it, right? But that's what the story requires. But at the end of the story, there's usually a lift at the end to take you home.
Exactly. And I mean, I think of like the Kaiju Preservation Society. You've got, oh gosh, your character goes through hell and back in that one. And, yep. You know, but by the time that you finish, you know, you finish on a more uplifting note, you know?
Yeah. Well, and like I said, because, you know, I want to believe that at the end of the day, we will get ourselves figured out. And again, I might be proven wrong, but there's that old thing, you know, the whole thing of something happens and it's like, oh, well, that's bad news. And, you know, we'll see. And then it turns out that that was actually a good thing.
We'll see.
You know, these the world continues, and nothing is ever completely settled. So,
do you feel a little nostalgic now that it is 20 years for Old Man's War and what you started with?
No. Not nostalgic per se. I mean, every once in a while it freaks me out. It's been 20 years. You know, that internal self-image thing. I don't feel particularly older. Then I look in the mirror and be like, oh no. Turns out you are older, right? Like I just very recently, this is a complete aside. From age 35 to 55, I basically had the same face. And then like in the last year, gels and all of that sort of stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. So now I have the face that I'm going to have until I'm 70, after which point I just go full raisin, you know? so, you know, but I do think about it in the sense of, I had a completely different life when the first Old Man's War book came out. I was mostly doing freelance work. I was writing, I was known as an author, but I was known as an author of nonfiction books, right? I had books on finance and astronomy and film, and no books on, you know, on science fiction novels, right? So it was, and I was doing a lot of consulting for tech firms and financial services firms. So just a completely different sort of writer's life. And then Old Man's War sold, and I said to Chrissy, I was like, look, you know, every once in a while, I'll write a book. Nobody makes a whole lot of money with it. Old Man's War, I got $6,500 for. And I was like, but they'll come out, and maybe I'll go to a convention, and people will be like, oh, yeah, you're the guy. You wrote that thing. Yeah, good for you. And, you know, like that, right?
Exactly.
I had no idea. I was 35, and Chrissy, I think I've met all the people that I'm ever going to meet, you know, like friends-wise. I was fine with that because I had a good set of friends. So, but just there's no way I could have known in 2005 how drastically my life was going to change over the next 20 years. Like the idea I'd win a fucking Hugo, guys. I mean, I just, no, come on. That's what you give to Robert Heinlein or Ursula K. Le Guin or something like that. It's like, no, you got one too. And I'm like, you let me into the club? Well, that's on you, isn't it? Right? All of that sort of stuff. Or being, you know, or being a best-selling author or going on a book tour. Like, you have no idea. Like, or maybe you do. Maybe you have done this. But it's not normal. I mean that in a very good way. Like, I'm going to spend 2 weeks going from place to place across the entire country doing this over and over and again. And like, that's not normal. That's not what people do. And I couldn't have expected it, right? So that's the thing that I feel, not nostalgia or not actually feeling old, but just a continual wonder of just how different my life is from what I expected it to be. I never expected to be a full-time novelist. I backed into this, right? Path of least resistance. Oh, you keep selling books. Make more of them. Okay. You keep selling more still. Okay. Well, then it doesn't make sense to do anything else.
I find your books are a relief. You know, I'm so glad when you come out with another book because I go in, and especially, I mean, in The Shattering Peace, where I was really worried, you know, I'm like, oh, geez, this has been a while since I've read Zoe's Tale.
Right.
What am I going to get myself into here? Will I remember these characters? I remember the characters. But what I really loved was the fact that this is a great launching into the series. You could read this and then go back and want to read others. And that's hard to do in science fiction. It's hard to do in fantasy. I think that it's amazing work.
Well, there were two things that were going on here. One, it was 10 years since the last book in the series. And I couldn't expect that the people who had read the series were going to go back and read every book. And as a lead up. Some of you have. Some of you have gone out of your way to say, I've just reread the entire series, just so you know. And then I listened to them. And then I read them again. And I'm like, that's a lot of, yeah, that's a commitment. You've made it a lifestyle, and that's great. But I can't assume that people have done that. I just assume that they were like, will get read it and be like, I hope I remember what's going on. And then the other thing is that some people will pick it up and not have read any of the other books at all. And I'm tend to be a believer, particularly with series, that you need to structure, or I do, I need to structure the books so that no matter where you interface with the series, you have enough information to go on that you can enjoy this one book, even if you haven't read all the other books in the series. Because who knows whether or not you're going to find any of the other books on the shelf, much less all six of the books on the shelf, right? If you go into your bookstore, there's a pretty good chance that they'll have Old Man's War, and they might have a couple of the other installments, but they may not necessarily have all of them. So I wanted to make, what it comes down to is don't give a reader a reason to put your book down. Make sure that you just have them comfortable with whatever it is that you're doing, basically from the first page. And so in the first two or three chapters of this, I literally catch you up on every single thing that you need to know through conversation, through discussion, through events that are going on, so that you aren't going to be lost. Even if you've never read Old Man's War before, you can figure out what's going on. If you have read Old Man's War before, there's going to be a lot of stuff in context that you are going to recognize and see, and that's going to make sense. But even if you haven't, you'll be fine. And then you can work your way back if you want or not. And you can move forward if this sells enough. Then maybe we'll write another.
I'm excited because we've just expanded our science fiction and fantasy area along with our horror, which is nice. So as we're growing and we're adding more in, it's always exciting to see, which is nice. Your books always do really well here, so no problem. And I'm sure you appreciate the royalty checks, but
I do. I bought a church.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. So when we talked back in 2023, we talked a little bit about you buying the church.
Yeah.
And you just bought it not that long ago. So tell us a little bit about the now, I mean, is it still a church? Is it? Tell us about it.
I want to be very clear that I have not started a religion. Science fiction writers starting religions does not tend to go well. We bought a church building because I wanted to have office space away from the office. My wife and I have started a business which is called Scholarly Enterprises, which is developing the IP for the books that we have and developing some projects that are not basically what I've already told Tor I was going to do for them. And so if that takes off and we need to hire people, we don't want them to be in our house, right? Reasonable enough. So we went looking for office space, and this church building went up for sale. It was huge, and it was awesome, and it was incredibly cheap. And one of my favorite things to do is show a picture of the church to people who live on the coasts and say, how much do you think that cost? And watch them get angrier and angrier the lower that they go. Right? Spoiler, we bought the thing for $75,000. Right, exactly. The thing you have to know is the reason that you can buy old churches for a really low price is because you're going to do a lot of work on them, right? And so we spent a multiple of that renovating it, but at the end of it, it was very nice. And it worked out very great. So we have, I have an office there. My daughter has an office there. My wife has an office there. We are all part of the Scalzi Enterprises empire. It's a family business where instead of making bagels, we make intellectual property. And then it actually turns out that it's, who knew, a church is a really good place to do events at. So, like, we do Christmas there. We do Thanksgiving there. We have family reunions there. My daughter let a friend do a baby shower there because we have so much space for it. It's better than having people over at our house because our pets don't freak out that there are people in their space. And then the people who have allergies, because we have four cats and a dog, don't immediately swell up like balloons. So it works out very well. And then we also did something recently that, because this church was part of the community for literally 100 years, we've started doing events. So we had a concert that we opened up to the community. We paid for it through the Scalzi Family Foundation, which is our charitable foundation. Brought in someone to do a concert, opened it up to the community. People came in and did that, and it went very well. So we're going to continue doing that and continue doing that sort of thing where we keep that building part of the life of the community as well as being our office space. So it's been great. I recommend everybody buy a church. I don't DJ there because where I live, there's really not much call for me to be a DJ. For those of you who don't know, I have a side gig as a DJ. And I know what you're thinking, pear-shaped. But I took 2 years of jazz and modern in high school, and my wife married me because she saw me dancing. I was like, I need to have that. And you laugh, but this is really what actually happened. The community that I'm in is not like they're like what we really need is a dance hall. That said, you know, I've been thinking is when Halloween comes around, we might be like, welcome to the sanctuary. And we'll do like goth stuff. But, you know, that would just be a party, not a real sort of DJ thing. But yes, I do DJing at, I did DJing at WorldCon. I do a set, the Nerd Prom on the Joko Cruise, which is a cruise I go on every year. I love it. It's the side gig nobody expects.
How many times have you played Time After Time?
As a DJ?
As a DJ.
None.
I'm thinking like the prom.
None.
You know?
What the hell? No. No.
Oh, good.
Okay. So, no slow dances. One. Because slow dances just bring you. You can't bring it out back up. And the thing about it is nerds are perfectly fine to be out there going, yes, we're dancing. But if you say, now it's time to get close with the person that you love, and they're like, oh, no one loves me. So it makes it very hard to slow things down. So no, basically my rule of thumb is just basically you get them on the dance floor. Like I said, you don't give them a reason to put down the book. Right. You don't give them a reason to leave the dance floor. My favorite thing is to like play a song and have people bouncing up and down, and they're like, I gotta quit. And then I put on another song and they're like, fuck. Right? Because yeah, it's exactly. A song they love and they have to go back. And it's basically making a bunch of middle-aged nerds have heart attacks on the floor.
You know, you're getting us in shape. Actually, Scalzi Enterprises.
Cardio is really important, guys. I don't know how to break it to you, but
I'm thinking Scalzi, you know, your very own like Richard Simmons style dancing with the nerds, you know?
Nerdicize?
Come on, nerds, it's time to move.
I would actually buy that.
That's
would be
terrifying.
Great.
Yeah. I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to think about it a lot now.
I hope so. And you know, those leg warmers.
Those leg warmers.
you got to keep them going. One of my all-time favorite little YouTube sketches, you know, where you see they go back to like the 1980s, you know, aerobics.
Yeah.
Dance, you know.
Yeah.
World championships, and it's hilarious.
Oh yeah, the Crystal Light World Aerobicized Championships.
It's brilliant.
Look it up on YouTube. If you lived in the 80s, it will be the weirdest flashback you've ever had. And if you didn't live in the 80s, you'll wonder what the hell was going on. And the answer was cocaine.
I was just going to say, yeah, they were probably pretty coked up.
That was, yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's pastels and sweat. It's a lot.
It's hilarious, but yeah, I'm picturing that a little bit. So I'm also picturing John Harris, you know, a stained glass window. in the John Harris style for your church, but also, you know, great covers.
Thank you. So John Harris started doing the covers for the Old Man's War series for the trade paperback of Old Man's War. The very first cover was by Donato Giancola, they swapped them out because John Harris has a very distinctive look, and he had also done the covers for example, Ender's Game, right?
Yep.
And so basically this is advertising to booksellers that says, hey, remember how Ender's Game sold? This book will sell like that, right? And it's also no coincidence that a few years later, John Harris also did the cover for Ancillary Justice, right?
Yeah.
Very much the same sort of messaging. And so we recently because we just did a new series of trade paperbacks for the 20th anniversary where they're sort of new and they're modern and so on and so forth. But for this, for the hardcover, we know that collectors want to have continuity with their covers. Yes, exactly. So we made sure that we had the John Harris. The trade paperback will have the more modern covers as well. So we're going to cover all bases.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I mean, what a nice way to have that, because it's, you know, John Harris's work is absolutely, it's not only is it a brand, but it is sort of a throwback a little bit to why we love science fiction.
Yeah, no, I mean, it evokes a very particular feel. I mean, you may love it or you may hate it, but you don't have any doubt what kind of book it is that you're reading when you have a John Harris cover. And it also makes a point, and I think this is actually really important, that these covers are not just, we don't just put them on there because they're cool. There's a lot of signaling that is going on. It's going on to booksellers. It's going on to readers. It is letting you know what kind of book it is. You know that this is a space opera book. You know that it's going to be, you know, have a certain tone and feel. Just like this one, you know, has an astronaut doing a selfie on a moon filled with cheese. This is not, you know, a book without whimsy, right? Or, as we were talking earlier, the starter villain cover.
Oh, yeah.
The starter villain cover, which has the picture of the cat on it. All of that stuff is 100% commercial art. This is an advertisement for the book that is in. And there's a lot of people who don't either don't understand it or don't get why it happens. There's, you know, the idea that some people's like, well, this cover is ugly. It's like, but you may think it's ugly or not this particular cover, but any cover, but it is doing a very specific thing, signaling to the sort of person who is going to read this sort of book that this is what you want. So that's what you do. Like I said, you look over here where we have all of these books with all these really awesome covers. The Brandon Sanderson there with a Michael Whalen cover, right? Michael Whalen, the master of, you know, fantasy art, on a cover for Brandon Sanderson. You know what you're getting there.
And it takes time. It takes time. It's not a cheap cover, which is nice. And,
No, it's a great cover. Everything, you know, and this is what I'm saying, the intentionality of it. There's so much that goes on. And this is one of the reasons that when people are like talking about publishers, because we live in an era now where people are doing independent publishing and publishing their own stuff, and I think that that's great. And this is not a criticism of that. But part of the result of that is sometimes people are like, you know, your publishers, they're a middleman. They're kind of just like sucking like money from you. I'd rather give money to you directly. I'm like, no, I want you to give money to the people who made this awesome cover and did the page design and did the copy editing and did literally everything that I would find and just enervating slog to do. I'm good at two things. I'm good at writing books and schmoozing, right? Hi. And those are the two things that I'm good at. I don't want to have to do literally all the rest of it. I don't want to do distribution. I don't want to have to try to convince booksellers to put my book in their store. I don't want to have to do copy editing. I once had a copy editor literally come over and strangle me because I was making her life difficult. So, you know, that's you know, the way I don't want to do page design. There are so many other people who will do such a better job of all of these things, and I want them to do the job, and I want them to get a cut. So don't ever think that this is, you know, the publishers aren't adding value to what I do.
I think self-publishing is just hard because you got to do everything.
It's so hard. It's so hard. I know people who self-publish, and I'm just like, I get tired thinking about all the stuff that you have to do. And like I said, some people love that. Some people absolutely want to be in control of every single aspect of it because that's who they are and that's their personality. And I think that's wonderful. And I think certainly we have seen over the course of 20 years, you know, people who have self-published have then moved on into traditional publishing. I mean, we were talking about Matt Dinneman right there. I'm looking at one of his books right now. Andy Weir. The first Old Man's War book back in 2002, I serialized on my website and told people if they liked it, send me money, right? Yeah. And then Tor came and said, we could publish that. I'm like, okay. All of that sort of stuff. But it was also, you know, the reason I put it up on my website, because as I thought about all the stuff I would have to do in order to try to, like, develop it and do something, I was like, oh, I'll just put it up on my website, you know. The idea of having to do all that work, just, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
It goes back to me being lazy.
So going back to talking a little bit about Ender's Game, because we talked about that a little bit in the back.
Sure.
I much prefer the idea of old people going out for war rather than the young people. And one of the things that really bothered me about Ender's Game was not that it isn't a great book, but boy, I mean, poor Ender Wiggin is just put through hell and back. And it's really all about kind of losing a little bit of your humanity in order to become a soldier.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in terms of I much prefer the idea that, hey, we've lived our life. And now we can go out and fight these wars. And what about it delighted you at the age of 35 with this idea?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that I'm going to mount a defense of Ender's Game as a piece of art. You're supposed to be incredibly uncomfortable about the fact that these children are being manipulated.
Absolutely.
That is the core of what's going on there. He did it what he was supposed to do with that. With me, I mean, I think part of it was two things were going on. I mean, I have a tendency to look at tropes and then try to twist them. And, you know, obviously people have done the military science fiction thing before. And there is that thing of, you know, the whole thing of old man's war, young man's fight sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Where all these people who are never going to be in the line of fire making decisions for people who haven't even gotten to live their lives. And so my brain was just rolling that around in my head, just going, well, what happens if you actually make people who have the life experience that they've had before, 70 years of life experience, and you put them on the front lines? What would change about it? How would they do things differently? And that intrigued me because, again, it was taking the Starship Troopers, Forever War, armor, Ender's Game model that we all knew, and introducing a kind of different twist to it. So part of that was just the way that it rolled in my brain. And then part of it is my marketing brain was like, nobody's done that quite that way. You could probably actually get away with that. And I remember driving down, we used to live in Virginia, and we were driving down to North Carolina to the Outer Banks with some friends of ours to have vacation. And I remember telling Chrissy about this idea on the way down, and she's like, yeah, it could work. And then I was like, then I told my friends at the vacation, and one of them was like, you will never get that off the ground. He wasn't being mean. He was just like, no, that's never going to fly. And, of course, my brain was just, I'll show you. I'll show you. And then, of course, it got published, and now it is what it is. And I swear, This friend is indeed a good friend. He's someone who I care about, I love. He's an important person to me. But every once in a while, I'm just like, I showed you. I showed you all. So that was it. I mean, it was the combination of here's a new twist. And you have to think about it. Because, again, you're right. When I wrote it, I was 2001 when I wrote it. So I was 32 years old when I wrote it. So I was basically faking life experience that I didn't have when I was writing the character of John Perry. But, I mean, that's part of being a writer anyway. You fake life experience that you don't necessarily have.
And you're able to interpret, and you get great people to, you know, help you figure it out, and, mm-hmm. and you produce a phenomenal novel. It takes a village a little bit to create a great novel, but it takes a good writer to do what you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
So, you guys are probably sick of me talking, and you guys probably have some questions, so I'm going to run around with the microphone, and you get the chance to ask John whatever you would like.
Okay. I have rules. Questions in the form of a question. Questions have one-part questions, and make the questions as short as you possibly can. And the reason we do that is not just because I'm a control freak, although I am. It's that we can get to as many questions as possible. You can tell that I tend to go on a bit. So, all right, let's do the first question.
All right, we got our first hand.
You mentioned not having readers need to reread the other six books, but do you have to reread the other six books so you know what?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I do, because I wrote Shattering Peace, and as I was reading Shattering Peace, as I was writing it, I wrote something about the physiology of one of the species of the book that later when I read an earlier book, I was like, oh no, I got that completely wrong. And fortunately, we were still in the editing phase, so I could go back and tweak the sentences and stuff like that. But it would have been extraordinarily embarrassing if that had actually made it to print. And remember that thing I told you about all of you being like,
Do you know you actually said in the earlier book that this was completely different?
I never would have heard of the end of it. So I am super glad I caught that. And the moral of the story is, yes, I have to read. Although sometimes, God's honest truth, sometimes when I can't remember stuff, I'll just go to social media and be like, hey, do you remember what I said about this? And someone's like, well, yes, I was just reading the book. And then they tell me, and I'm like, no, that's right. So, yeah, sometimes I will crowdsource. Yes, next question.
Hi. One of my big things is I actually enjoy the audio versions of the books.
Yes.
I haven't read really any of your books hardback. What aspect of when you're writing your book, are you now thinking, who's going to read my book for Audible?
Yes. Well, two things happen. One, because I know that there is going to be an audiobook, because literally I have my contracts are with Tor are mirrored with Audible. So as long as a book comes out from Tor, it's going to come out from Audible. So and it usually comes out on the same day. So so there will always be someone reading. So that has done two things. One, you can tell there's a dividing line between when I started being aware that I was writing for audio as well and before. Because before, I would say, said as a dialogue tag a whole lot. If you read Red Shirts, it's there. Like, every line says said. Because when you're reading the book, you don't process it. You know it's there, but you just kind of skip over it. But they are contractually obliged to say said. They're contractually obliged to read every single word that's in there. And so when I first heard Red Shirts and literally every sentence ended with said, I was like, who the fuck told this guy he could write? Right? So I became very aware that I needed to change how I was doing dialogue tags. So that was literally the dividing line was Red Shirts. Because before that, not every one of my books had been turned into audiobooks. And then after that, every one of them did. So that made a huge difference. The second thing is, yes, absolutely, I do think about who's going to be reading them. So, and I will, this is going to sound weird, but so Old Man's War, most of the books were read by William Dufresne, who is a wonderful narrator. He passed away recently. But two of the books were also were read by Tavia Gilbert. So she read Zoe's Tale, and she read parts of, I think, The End of All Things, right? So when it came time to write The Shattering Peace, not only was I thinking about, like I had been thinking about Gretchen for a while, But also, I was thinking about the fact that as a matter of continuity for the audiobooks in the series, it made sense to have a woman protagonist so that I could use Tavia Gilbert again to continue the continuity of the series in terms of the audiobooks. So yeah, it is absolutely something I think about. And I think about, you know, and the fact that, you know, aside from the Old Man's War series, Will Wheaton does a lot of my books. And Will is, you know, a good friend of mine. I just saw him last week when I was in Portland, and we were talking about doing narration and stuff like that. And it's really funny because some people really love how Will narrates my stuff, and some people don't like it. And my feeling about it is, well, I like it, and if you don't like it, there are other formats for you to enjoy that book. So there you go. Next question.
Speaking of Will Wheaton, for the head-in locked...
head-on and lock-in.
Yeah, sorry. Long day at work. I noticed that you had two different people read those. And when
right.
I was talking with my friends, I said that it was because you never refer to the character by a gender. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So the lock-in series and the... so that's lock-in and head-on. The main character, Chris... gender's never specified, and that's partly because Chris wanders around in a Threep body, which is an android body, and the android bodies aren't going to be gendered unless the person who owns the Threep decides to make gender obvious. So if you were to deal with someone in a Threep, you wouldn't necessarily know what their gender was. So that was part of the reason to do that. And I didn't make a big deal about it. I didn't tell my editor I did it. He was very surprised when I did it. And we didn't tell reviewers. We didn't tell people the book came out. We didn't mention it. We just wanted to see if people would pick up on it or not. And some people do and some people don't. I also did it with Kaiju Preservation Society. Jamie, the gender was never revealed. Because I wrote two chapters and I was like, I haven't gendered this person yet. I guess I won't. So there you have it. Next question.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Can you talk a little bit about the revision process for you, specifically working with your editor on that?
So when I tell people this, they hate me. So Kaiju Preservation Society and Kaiju Preservation Society, Starter Villain, and actually When the Moon Hits Your Eye, there's no revision. I put it in. That was the book. My editors were like, yeah, that works. And then off we go. Shattering Peace, there was a little bit of revision, but only I think I had to change like 7 or 8 sentences and maybe a paragraph. I've written 19 novels, and over the course of those 19 novels, I've maybe had 5 pages of edits. And so, when I tell other writers that, they're like, okay, I need to push you out of a moving car right now. And the reason, there's 2 reasons that this happens. One, I revise as I go along. So I write on a computer, and you can do that when you're writing on a computer. And so by the time it gets done, I've done all the editing that I was going to do, and I just kind of send it in. The other thing is that for years and years I was a journalist, and you have to learn to write reasonably clean copy, or, you know, you get strangled by your copy editor. Typically doing those 2 things, it means that basically when I put the book done, there's very little revision that needs to be done from that point forward. There are writers who I know who basically turn in a book and they say to the editor, please God, please help me with this. And then they're very intensive with their editors, and that's great for them. And that's their process. But my process has always been, I turn it in and it's done. So, yes.
In the foreword to The Ghost Brigades, you said that people might think a second book is easier, but it wasn't. How has it been now? You're to 7. Has it is it consistent or up and down?
So the thing about writing a, there's that old saying, and it's attributed ultimately to Gene Wolfe, where they where he says the thing that writing a novel teaches you is how to write that novel, and then every single novel is different from there. And that continues to be the case. I mean, one of the things that is true is, like, when you write your first novel, generally speaking, you have all the time in the world to write it because nobody's waiting for it, right? And then when the second novel happens, it's because you've got a deadline. This happens in music, too, where they talk about the first album takes 10 years and the second album you get 9 months, which is why sophomore novels are often, or albums are very disappointing. And the thing about it is that, so you can sit there and you're like, all right, well, now I have to do this thing, and it has to be done by this particular time. And I think a lot of people freak out a little bit about it, which is why deadlines get blown and so on and so forth. This is, again, where journalism helped me, because I just got it drilled into my head. There's no excuse for not having your thing done on deadline. But no, it never gets easier. I don't want to say that it gets harder. It's just every single time it's different. Like, I'm writing a new book now. Literally, like, I finished a chapter last night, right? So that I could read it while I'm on tour. Not here, because we're doing the Q&A thing. Sorry. Although I can read you the first sentence of it, if you would like. Hold on, I will pull that up. But the thing about it is that each time it's its own thing. And that's perfectly fine. You get used to the idea that, there are things that you will be able to take from the previous novels and the previous experience. And there are some things that you won't. And every single one, it puts new tools in your toolbox, changes the way that you do stuff, and you just accept that that's part of it. So here is this is the first line of the upcoming novel, which is, it is a warm August evening in Ohio. The sun has just set, and you are a rabbit. Now, if you think that there's anything in any previous book that's going to help me write a chapter from the point of view of a fucking rabbit, turns out the answer is no. So that was a whole thing that I had to do basically from scratch, which took me a long time to do, because I don't know if you know this, writing from the point of view of a rabbit is not as easy as it sounds. So every single time that you do it, it's something new. So, and like I said, that's part of the fun of it. On the other hand, it would be easier for deadlines if you just kind of cranked it out over and over again. But I think it's better this way.
A lot of watching Bugs Bunny cartoons, right?
No. Although I will say this, that one of the foundational writers for me as someone who writes humor as someone who kind of sees how story gets done is Michael Maltese. Michael Maltese, he wrote roughly half of the Looney Tunes. He wrote Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century, wrote Duck a Monk, What's Opera Doc, Some Froggy Evening, almost all of the Roadrunner stuff. He is literally one of the funniest people of the 20th century, and it makes me angry that he is not appreciated in the same way as some of the other great writers of cinema have been from the 20th century. So Michael Maltese, learn his name, put some respect on it, because that was a funny guy. But no, Bugs Bunny has nothing to do with it.
On that note, I think I'm looking at people, these are called sudden comfort chairs, where you suddenly discover that they're no longer comfortable. And it's usually about an hour is about all your butt can stand. John, we've got some giveaways tonight.
Oh, cool.
So we always like the authors to shout out a number. We've given out tickets 1 through 29. The first book I'd like to give away, just to torture the person, is book three in a lit RPG series by Seth Ring that comes out this month. Came out September 2nd. It is the Apex series. It's published by Blackstone, who's doing some really cool stuff with horror and science fiction. Can you give us a number between 1 and 29?
16.
All right. Who has 16 in their book? Excellent. Sir, you have won that book. The next one is going to be Haley Piper, her newest horror novel. What I really like about her stuff is she sort of turns horror and gender on her head, and you have got an erotic horror novel, which, wow, spicy. So you can't be under 18, but I think we're good here. John, 1 through 29 again.
22.
All right, who has 22? Excellent. You have won the erotic horror novel. Congratulations.
Spicy.
This is a Game in Yellow, and somebody has quoted the new queen of cosmic horror, and it's Ginger Nuts of Horror. I don't know who Ginger Nuts of Horror
Ginger
is.
Ginger Nuts of Horror is actually a well-established horror website. It's been around for a couple of decades. So it is not just some random thing. It's actually a decent endorsement.
Oh, excellent. All right. So for those of you who would like to get your book signed, while we get John set up here, if we could ask you, this is the unfortunate time where we ask you to move furniture. If you could fold up your chair and move it to the side where the cookbooks are, if you move it to the side where the romanticy and sci-fi